To order, the time is 1:03 p.m. Members present at this time, Representative Chris Birch, Representative Justin Parrish, Vice Chair Representative John Lincoln, Co-Chair Representative Andy Josephson, and myself, Representative Tarr. Please let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Ms. Debbie Tillinghast, and our LIO moderator, Leah Kraft. Thank you to both of you for being here. We can ask folks to silence their cell phones. We just have one bill on the agenda today, and this is one that got introduced, I think, actually at the beginning of 2017. And this is the first hearing on it. This is one of the issues that I've worked on quite a bit, and so wanted to take advantage of us still being in session to at least hold one hearing on it and start this conversation. And so that's what's happening today. And welcome to Representative Tallarico. I don't expect it'll take very long. It's the only agenda item we have. And so I'll just go through it. We can have a discussion. And then I think that'll be the end of the meeting for today. Anybody have anything else at this time? Okay. Then I will hand the gavel over and present. Good afternoon, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee. I'm Representative Garen Tarr from District 19 in Anchorage, here to present House Bill 28, Cosmetic Ingredient Disclosure. And I just want to give a little context. We talked earlier this session about the flame retardants, and these are issues that I've worked on for quite a number of years in terms of chemicals in our environment that have either adverse health impacts or adverse impacts to the environment. And just talked about some of the deficiencies in the way those chemicals are regulated and our knowledge of them. And I just want to sort of set the stage. It'll sound very similar to the conversation today, although this one is specific to cosmetic ingredient disclosure. So cosmetics are regulated under two federal laws, the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act and the Fair Packaging and Labeling Act. Of course, one is more about the regulation of the ingredients, and the other is about how they're marketed or presented to the public. But what's important about the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act is while it requires disclosure of some ingredients, it does not require disclosure of all ingredients, including fragrances, flavors, and color additives. And so when you look at this bill, you'll notice Section 1 is the substantive part of the bill in terms of what it does, and it specifically states that the requirement that we're talking about would require a manufacturer, just on their internet website, so it's not a change in packaging necessarily, but just on their website, to list the full ingredients in the cosmetic, including fragrances, flavors, and color additives. And so it's just important to kind of put that in context, that the reason that you have to otherwise require it is the laws that regulate these products require some disclosure, but not all, and so the ones that we're looking at. And under these personal care products, that term is used pretty broadly, but just want to give people an understanding of the regulatory environment. So some things are regulated as cosmetics, some things are regulated as drugs, and then some things are regulated as both. And so cosmetics, lipsticks, personal, you know, the kind of things you apply, perfumes, shampoos, those kind of things. Drugs, they're regulated in that way if they're supposed to have some kind of therapeutic or medicinal benefit to them. And so you can see these, like the lip balm, diaper ointment, mouthwashes, antiperspirants. You know, all of those are additionally marketed, not just as a product that you use, but because it has some additional benefit. And then some that are both, like the example I use here, the anti-dandruff shampoo. So the shampoo part makes it a cosmetic. The anti-dandruff part makes it a drug. So then it's regulated as both a cosmetic and a drug. And so I had this in the earlier one about the flame retardants, and I guess, again, what I just want the point to be clear is that there's a lot sort of unknown in this and a lot that isn't tested. So even though we do have regulations, laws in place, more needs, you know, to be learned, much more needs to be done. And that's just the environment of how we regulate chemicals. We're continually doing research, continually learning new things. And unfortunately, and I just want to stress this again, because sometimes in the legislative context, it becomes sort of, you know, say an environmental position versus a business position. And I don't think that's a helpful dichotomy. I mean, you know, I think It's just we have to approach it that we do the best we can with the knowledge we have today, but we're learning new things every day. And as we learn new things, then we need the regulatory environment to evolve with the new information. And then we need new products to be developed that have less harmful components to them. And we talked a little bit about the exposure in the case of the flame retardants, right? We were more interested in the inhalation part of it, but in this case, we're more interested in absorption because these are the products that you apply directly to your skin. So just several of the slides here have images from what's called the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics. And it's a really good website I want to point people to, and partly why I thought it'd be worthwhile to even have this hearing is just for anybody that hears this information or sees this presentation, these are the resources where I would point people to go and learn more. But you can see the picture on the left. You can count up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, I think it is there. We say on average women use between 10 to 20 personal care products every day. With men, that's a little closer to 10 to 12. And so if each of those products has some components of it that may be concerning, then you're having a lot of exposure on a daily basis. The list of chemicals, these are sort of a top 10 list of things that people might be worried about. Some of these will look familiar to you. Formaldehyde, I'm sure people have heard of before, you know, some of these other products. But some of them, you know, you may not be aware are used in the personal care products, like mercury, for example, used in mascara. A lot of women don't know that there's mercury in the mascara that they put on every day. And there could be reasons, and this wouldn't be true for every person, but there could be reasons because of compromised immune system, if you're a cancer survivor or something like that, or you have other health issues that, you know, being exposed to some of these could be problematic. The two that I've highlighted there, the parabens and the phthalates, I'm going to spend a little more time talking about because those are ones that people have generally heard of. And again, these are from the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics, but these two examples, so for example, the parabens, where they're found, shampoos, conditioners, lotions, facial shower cleansers, and scrubs. You can see those names on the label. If anybody's ever picked up a bottle of shampoo and looked at the 45 ingredients listed on the back of it, you've seen some of these words. And I mean, I know in my own life, when we look at those things, we just mostly joke. We have, you know, what is that? We don't know, right? So it's, even though some of these things may be listed, most people aren't aware really of what that product is or what it does or why it's even used. Parabens are preservatives, and they're commonly used to prevent the growth of bacteria and mold. And so that's why they're actually used in the product. And, you know, it's not that we would disagree with that use, but we may need to find a different chemical that can have the same impact on the product without the adverse health effects. Phthalates, those are another one that people have heard of. And I want to mention these specifically because they're found in synthetic fragrances, nail polish, and hairspray. And if you go back to what's disclosed and what's not disclosed, you know, when you look at those fragrances not being required to be disclosed, and then you look at this particular ingredient and see that it's a fragrance, you know, you're not even going to know that that component is in the product you're using if they're not required to disclose that ingredient. So you can see just different ways that that's used, some of the health concerns we've talked about with the same thing with the flame retardants, the endocrine disruption, et cetera. And you can also see that the United States, in terms of regulation, is a lot different than other places in the world. In the EU in particular has done much more extensive research on these chemicals, and you can see, you know, in some cases has banned them. Another couple of these just to keep in mind. So, you know, the lead and other heavy metals I had mentioned before is some of these components. Look at the regulations, banned, found unsafe and for use in cosmetics in Canada, Japan, and the European Union, restricted in cosmetics in the U.S., right? So, you know, in some ways we have some restrictions, but in some we're behind. On the left hand, I wanted to put that just because, again, these fragrances are the things that are not required to be disclosed. And you can see there's some ingredients here that we would be of concern, including the two I just mentioned, the parabens and the phthalates. These are some of the health concerns. Those were on the previous slide, so I don't need to talk through all of those. But I want to make the point again about what makes this so challenging to understand the true impact is if you remember the other chemicals we talked about, the flame retardants, some of those are on both lists. And so if you have a person who, you know, has evidence of this health issue, it becomes really difficult to unwind and figure out which exposure it may have been to cause that health problem. And we get into that conversation about causation versus correlation. And in the policy environment, people really want causation. They really want to be able to say with certainty that a person was exposed to this chemical and that's what led to the cancer and that's why we have to ban that chemical. It's just very, very difficult to be able to have that level of preciseness in terms of what a person was exposed to. And so some folks working in this area talk about the precautionary principle. And what that suggests is sort of shifting the burden in the other direction so that a manufacturer, before they can use a chemical, would have to prove that it doesn't have any adverse health impacts or impacts to the environment. Now we're kind of on the other side of it where we do risk assessment and we kind of wait to observe problems and then we try to backpedal and make changes. So those are sort of two very different management paradigms and regulatory paradigms, if you will. So what it looks like at the store, if you've seen some of the products, you'll start to notice, and I hope after this you'll notice if you hadn't before. It's pretty small, but at the bottom of the two products on the left in that golden bar, you can see it says paraben-free. In the product on the right, you know, along the things that are listed, no sulfates, no colorants, no parabens. And so there is a recognition that some of these things are not safe in consumer products, even though we haven't banned their use, but the research has shown, and so the consumer pressure is on the companies to change and use alternatives. So, you know, same thing kind of happened with the other chemicals we talked about. In some cases, it's been too difficult to get changes made to the law that are more restrictive, but the consumer pressure and consumer demand for different choices is evolving what's available. This is just another example of some of these natural products that people could use. And just to underline that there really are products out there. It may take a little bit more work and it may be a little bit more expensive in some cases. But if you're a cancer survivor and you're looking to be very careful about what products you use so that you don't otherwise stress your immune system as you're in recovery and trying to heal and regain your health, then this kind of information can be really important, and you want to have as much consumer knowledge as possible. And I guess that's sort of foundational of this idea is that a consumer should have as much information as necessary or needed so they can make a good consumer choice and know what they're getting. I just wanted to point out a couple websites if anybody's interested. This one is called the Skin Deep Cosmetics website. And so you can go, they have 74,000 products here, and just depending on what, you know, whatever you use, you could go and you can type it in and see if they've done an evaluation of it. And they'll give you, you know, what issues may be of concern, what component, what is known and not known. And I think, again, you know, with more and more people, one of the things I worked on before was with breast cancer survivors. And so here are women who have, you know, had breast cancer, they've gone through treatment, they're in recovery, they do not want to be a repeat cancer survivor. One of the programs we were working with was giving these women a bunch of cosmetics. You know, if you lose your hair and you go through that whole treatment, you're not feeling as good about your personal appearance. You know, one of the things was to give these women a lot of cosmetics. To, you know, help them as they're recovering feel like they have the makeup or whatever they want to look good. But then it turns out some of the chemicals used in the cosmetics they're giving these breast cancer survivors are actually cancer-causing or otherwise could stress their immune system. And so, you know, there, you know, may not be everyone that needs this information or feels like they need it, but there are certainly people who have health conditions, or a pregnant woman, for example, that doesn't want to unnecessarily expose the baby, you know, in utero. You know, there could be reasons that they wouldn't want to be exposed to these chemicals too. The other one that I mentioned was the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics, and that's a really good website, and it's actually a project of the Breast Cancer Fund, and it's from this very work where breast cancer survivors were looking into the products they were using to understand that, in fact, some of them, you know, were unsafe and could otherwise compromise their health. And I worked with a woman from the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics who wrote a book about this. And, of course, it's big business. Billions of dollars are spent on these personal care products for men and women. And so, as you can imagine, when there's that kind of money on the line, people get engaged on the issues. And there are a lot of instances. People, I'm sure, have heard about animal testing, things like that. You know, those issues have risen to the level of common knowledge and are part of conversations. But this is a little less known, and why we wanted to bring the bill to the body today, because we had a few minutes and just love the opportunity to share some of this so that people are better informed. And so the bill, again, what it would do is just basically require that the manufacturer have available on their website the information about the products that aren't otherwise listed. And for the consumers who are interested, it's a right-to-know kind of provision. You can go to the website. You can look and see if it's something that you aren't interested in. You don't ever have to go to the website and look at it. But not anything where these get much more complicated is if you require, and this what happened with the GMO stuff, for example, if you require the products themselves to list all the ingredients, then it does become much more costly because they have to remanufacture the bottles and change all that. But if you're just saying it needs to be available on your website, it's a much easier endeavor. So with that, I will wrap up and take any questions.
Yes, Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess one of the questions I have is there a threshold number or quantity when you talk about ingredients that have to be listed? And the reason I bring that up and raise the question is I took a class many, many years ago in atomic absorption spectroscopy, and it's basically a process of measuring content of elements, and you can get down to parts per billion, which are virtually undetectable even some years ago. But we've got a little there's a little of something that you might not like everywhere, and I guess I'm just wondering, is there a threshold number on that in an ingredients list, and I'm just not sure how that would be broken out, because you can probably find some nasty stuff in just about anything if you measure it down in small enough units. And I'm just wondering what you have here, what you're proposing here.
Thank you, Representative Birch, through the chair. On page one, this is in section B, lines 9-12. It says the list of ingredients in this section would be in descending order of the predominance of each ingredient in the cosmetic, except that a manufacturer may list an ingredient without respect to order of predominance if the ingredient is present in the cosmetic at a concentration of 1% or less. So that, refers back to that. And I understand what you're saying there. And, again, I think that's why if you use the option of just doing the website posting, it becomes a lot easier to, even if it is a lengthy list, know. And I think there's some push among the people working on these issues to, have that level of disclosure to really understand what the products are, because this is a case, and like you're saying, and there's probably something nasty in everything. Fillers, for example, if you're a person who wants to buy herbal supplements at a store, you don't want to buy the ones that are really inexpensive, because those ones are probably some small percentage of herbal supplement and a high percentage of filler in that capsule, for example. One of the reasons people are concerned when you buy a product made in China, one of the things they use is a filler on their glazes, for example, in like a houseware product that you might buy, is lead. Well, you don't want to microwave that, and that's why a lot of those dishes say do not microwave, but people, of course, probably do microwave and use those, so then now you've changed, by the heat addition, potential exposure. And so part of it, I think, there's an interest in really understanding what all is in there so that we can understand, well, is there any reason to be concerned even in the smallest percentages of what things are? Because, for example, with endocrine disruptors, one of the things that's so challenging about the health impacts is that even the small exposure, even limited exposure can be problematic, versus what we would expect is it have to be more, regular, you know, that you'd have to be exposed to these chemicals on a daily basis for an extended period of time, and that would cause a problem. But what we're learning is in some cases, even limited exposure can be a problem. So it's not, the idea isn't to be overly burdensome in terms of what you would require to be listed, but just more to understand, in fact, what products are used and if there are safer alternatives.
Follow up, Representative Birch. We've been joined by Representative Rauscher at 120.
I was kind of curious as to what your motivation was, if it was some sort of personal experience or whether the ingredients list that I see in my shampoo today is somehow or another wrong. I mean, I don't remember doing this, but were I to look at my morning shampoo, would that have all the information on it I need, or is this proposing to change that somehow as far as what the content of that product is?
Through the chair to Representative Birch, the big difference would be on the fragrances. What you'll generally see on a product list is it'll just say the word fragrance, mm-hmm. but it won't list what's in it. And so that's why I wanted to bring up the example here of the phthalates, because that's where the fragrances are found. So you might see it say fragrance, but you're not going to see it listed as having phthalates. Mm-hmm. And the phthalates are the part we're concerned about. So that is a little, you might, you know, see some of it, like on the parabens, you know, if you look at those, I'm sure you've seen those before, ethylparaben, butylparaben, you know, methylparaben. I know I've definitely, because when I first started learning about a lot of this and was really looking at labels, I was frequently looking at them saying, what the heck is this? So I know I've seen, you know, a lot of those. But, for example, because it's not required to disclose the fragrance ingredients, you wouldn't see the phthalates.
Madam Co-Chair, sure. So under this bill, you would have to, the manufacturer would have to list more items, presumably, but then the consumer would have to be very vigilant and sort of ambitious about looking into the product. Am I right about that?
Through the chair, yes. And that's why I think, and I wanted to show these products here, because with consumer pressure and what we've learned, you know, you do start to see, there's no requirement that you say you're using parabens or phthalates, right, particularly if it's in the fragrance. There's no requirement to list that. But what's happening alternatively is the products that aren't using them are listing that. So you'll pick up a package that says paraben-free, or you'll pick up no phthalates. So they're self-identifying because they know there is consumer demand for that. And major projects, Walmart, for example, because some of these also have the endocrine-disrupting qualities, they're moving away from having cosmetics that have some of these concerning additives in them. So you think about the market share that Walmart has and the influence that can have, it's pretty substantial.
Well, and I would note that there was a bill on the floor today that I believe is a Representative Stutz bill, or actually it may have come over from the Senate, but it had been Representative Sadler's bill that we heard in Labor and Commerce, and it requires the state of Alaska to be more vigilant about oversight of wholesale pharmaceuticals, mm-hmm. because those can come in from overseas and you can't be sure. They can look like they're supposed to look mm-hmm. on the outside of the tablet, but they can be essentially phony.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm reminded of that. Yeah. And if I may, there was a story that was interesting a couple of years ago. I remember Mayor Berkowitz was one of the subjects of the study.
Mm-hmm.
But there were a dozen or so Alaskans who were selected. And what they found is that through use of chemicals in the modern era, that there were sort of blueprints, chemical blueprints, as it were, that stayed with you. You could tell essentially what the exposure levels were. Do you have some knowledge of what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering whether over time you can shake away from that, sort of that is, if you lived in the wild for 20 years, would that blueprint still be there?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, I do recall I was working actually with the organization that did that at the time, Alaska Community Action on Toxics, and the answer sort of yes and no in terms of what's showing up when they do that. Some of the chemicals bind in your fat cells, and so there is a way, you know, to metabolize and get rid of them. Other chemicals linger much longer, and that becomes more problematic. But I'm glad you said that, because when I was working on these, one of the most alarming things I've learned, and I think I mentioned this with the flame retardants, was they tested the breast milk of women in northern Canada with no industry around. You would think, you know, they're living in a very pristine environment, that there wouldn't be evidence of chemical exposure. Mm-hmm. But in fact, when they tested the breast milk, and then they've done blood cord analysis for developing fetuses, when they've done that testing, they have found chemicals present that are used nowhere in that vicinity, but because of global wind and water patterns, mm-hmm. have, you know, helped those things migrate to the northern climates, and then that's how the women are exposed. Mm-hmm. So it is very concerning that you can be exposed to things even, you know, just without your knowledge. You think you're in a place where that wouldn't be an issue, but in fact it could be. And it just depends on which thing. But, for example, we talk about the POPs, the persistent organic pollutants, mm-hmm. right? So there are some that persist in the environment and others that, you know, break down more rapidly and are less harmful when they do.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Roger.
Thank you, Chairman Josephson. Through the chair, I was just, why are they not required to have these types of things labeled now?
Well, that's a good question. Through the chair to Representative Roucher, a lot of the laws are dated, you know, decades and decades old. So the main federal law that this is regulated under, the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act is, oh gosh, I'm going to get the year wrong, but it's decades and decades old. So
I won't try that.
But the thinking before, and why it's so important, some of the research that's been done in understanding human exposure, is that some of these chemicals were not a problem. And so I don't think it was developed in such a way that people knowingly thought there'd be exposure to things that were harmful. I think it was evolved in such a way where they thought that the information being disclosed was what people needed. And part of it is because some of, going to back what Representative Birch asked about, you know, some of the things were in small enough quantities. People were sort of estimating the impact based on the relative amount of that used in the particular product. But what we've learned is that even in some cases, small exposure, you know, can be a problem. And so I think it's just more a reflection of what we've learned and our newer understanding. I mean, these are, when you go back and look at some of the research, it's, you know, health studies that are being done in the last 10 and 20 years to more fully understand this. And I think it's, you know, we're trying to update and evolve these laws as we have new information.
And follow up? Thank you. So the federal government, how far behind this are they? Say this is the pass, HB 28. How far behind HB 28 is the federal government?
Through the chair to Representative Rauscher, can you help me understand what...
Well, if it was a federal, in my opinion, it was a federal... If this, the federal law already included this, it would be happening. So it's mm-hmm. not.
Right.
And so what we're doing is we're going a step stringenter, which is a state can do.
Mm-hmm.
Through the chair, too, by the way. I'm sorry. But, so we're allowed to be more stringent, but we can't be less stringent.
Mm-hmm.
So if it doesn't exist already, then obviously the federal mm-hmm. mandates aren't there to assure us that this would be in place. So now we're trying to cover ground that's not happening. So I'm just trying to figure out how far is the federal government behind us
mm-hmm.
in terms of catching up if to where they care,
mm-hmm.
I guess. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair to Representative Rauscher, it does. Thank you very much. And I was saying right before I think you came in that one of the challenges is that these conversations often get sort of pitted in two categories, sort of, you know, environmental or consumer safety versus business. And that makes change at the federal level difficult. The law that we talked about before that was recently updated, the TSCA, the Toxic Substances Control Act, you know, that one hadn't been updated in over 40 years, and people spent a good gosh, it must have been 6 to 8 years working on getting that one updated. Mm-hmm. So it becomes a pretty challenging endeavor at the federal level, and I think that's why some of the states have taken action. But it was good because states were working on that updates of their own to TSCA, and that prompted federal action. I think something like this could happen in the same way, where if states continue to work on it, it will prompt federal action. But what's so interesting about it is that absent federal law, because of consumer pressure, and that's why I wanted to have a couple of these slides in here, you know, there's still changes happening now because of consumer pressure. And so some of these chemicals that are of most concern, or additives that are most concerning, are being removed from products, not because we changed the law, but because as the science is available and consumers learn, they stop buying them, and so the manufacturers in turn start making new ones. But what I would hope is, when we talk about these things, that instead of it being sort of two sides pitted against each other, we can think about it again. I don't think anybody ever has the intention of harming someone or harming the environment, but we have new information. So that's the thing that's changed. Now we have new information. And then what I hope it can do is inspire new product development, which is a great economic opportunity, whether it be in personal care products or the products we use in our home. Hopefully we can sort of move in that direction. And I know what some states, and we were talking about this a little bit a few years ago here for Alaska, if we had some money, I think there's a lot of opportunity in the retail market for new product development. And so some states are putting like calling it green chemistry for, you know, just sort of a generic term, but putting some money into that so that, you know, the people who are developing these products now are looking to develop them with additives that don't persist in the environment or cause adverse human health effects.
Okay, and then just one last follow-up question. Thank you, through the chair. Where do I go to find out what's in the products I buy if they're not all on there?
Glad you asked. I will go back. So this is my recommendation. There's this. It's from the Environmental Working Group, but they work with scientists, and, you know, there's information about who they are, so you could decide for yourself if you want to trust this. But they have 74,000 products, so I'll just pick one that we could look at. I think I spelled that right. Favorite. So you know, they say, let's look at L'Oreal Paris Hair Expertise Evercream Intense Nourishing Shampoo. With a name like that, how could you go wrong? But so they look at the overall hazard here. Doesn't seem to have information about cancer or developmental, you know, allergies. So they can tell you about that. So, for example, you know, their fragrance in here, they can don't have additional information, but that's the fragrance that they have tested, and some of the other ingredients if you want to read about them. And they have this color-coded thing, so where a low-hazard thing is a 1 to 2, a moderate hazard 3 to 6, and then a high-hazard 7 to 10. And the thing is, again, and I'm repeating myself, I apologize, because I think you came in after I said this, but we're always looking, you know, this challenge is this causation versus correlation, and, you know, did I use this product and it caused a harmful, you know, health situation for myself? Well, we use a lot of things, and we're exposed to a lot of things. So when I work on this and the way I think about it, you know, we're not saying that one individual thing is going to be your downfall, you know, you're going to get cancer from that. But it's when you look at your whole health, you know, experience, or your, you know, how do you live every day, it's going to be, you know, the combination of the things you eat and the exercise you get and the products you're exposed to. But if you eat poorly and you don't exercise and, you know, you're otherwise living an unhealthy life, you know, and in addition to that, you're using products that have potential immunotoxicity or reproductive, you know, impacts, things like that. You know, it's the combination of those things that can become really problematic. And so it's not just ever, you know, sort of the one thing that you do, but it's what's the cumulative impact. And that's why for women, if they're using, you know, 12, 15, 20 products every single day, that may be a reason to be worried. And I was telling this story. You'll notice this Campaign for Safe Cosmetics is a project of the Breast Cancer Prevention Partners, because working with breast cancer survivors and folks doing research on that, what we've learned is, you know, unfortunately, some of the products the women were using could have had adverse impact on them. And then once you're a cancer survivor, you're much more conscious about what you expose yourself to because you want to limit unnecessary exposures.
Sure. Good. And we were joined at 1:32 by Representative Drummond. Let the record reflect. Co-Chair Tarr, is there more?
No. I really just want to thank everybody for giving me a few minutes to talk about this today. It's just important information. We have a lot of people, young women and men in this building working, and I just thought it'd be a nice opportunity for anybody who, you know, would be able to see it to kind of learn a little bit more and then know where some resources are if they want to learn anything else.
Okay. All right, and I will distribute the PowerPoint and upload it to BASIS after the meeting. Any other questions or comments? Yes, Representative Drummond.
Thank you. I'm sorry I missed the beginning of this. I'm really interested in what Alaskan businesses are doing in terms of producing personal care products. I know that right across the street from my house is the Denali Dreams Soap Company that makes all kinds of wonderful products, soaps that do not contain sodium lauryl sulfate, for example, mm-hmm. or the equivalent of Dawn. You don't want to be washing your hair and stripping all the oils from it and all of that other stuff like a dish detergent. But there's lots of folks in the valley. I know there's what are their names? There's just a lot of producers in Alaska that are already mm-hmm. making personal care products of all mm-hmm. kinds, and it would be wonderful to take a look at them
mm-hmm.
Instead of the outside companies where I'm told by. Former tenant who was an engineer in a shampoo plant back east one time. He said that they just used to change the coloration that they put in the shampoo and the fragrance in it, and all of that stuff back in the day was the same formulation. I think we've gotten a lot smarter about the things that we put on our bodies.
Thank you. And I just would quickly add, we do have it here, so it's been over 75 years since the Cosmetic Food and Drug Act has been required. I couldn't remember, I thought, because most of them were early 1900s when they passed, and there's a number here, $71 billion cosmetic industry. So some major dollars at play here.
I'm just trying to figure out which ingredient in my shampoo is causing my hair to thin out so much. So
it just started it.
Yeah, it just started.
Yeah. That's your mother's fault. No.
Thank you.
All right. Anything more, Co-Chair?
No, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for the presentation. With that, we will adjourn, unless there's any comments for the will of the committee. We'll adjourn at, yes, Representative Rauscher.
Was today the day for amendments for, the oil bill?
No.
It wasn't?
No. We're still on the record.
Yes,
sort
we're still
of
on record.
Representative Tarr.
The question was, is today the day for amendments on House Bill 288?
No.
When is it?
We have not decided if we'll bring that bill back up before the committee.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we would give at least 24 hours notice before that.
Okay. All right, thank you.
So we'll let everybody know before close of business tomorrow.
All right, we'll appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Okay. We'll be adjourned at 1:41.